Here's a question for you. When was the last time you opened a JEP chart and thought about where it actually came from? Not Boeing. Not the Denver publishing house it grew into. Not the company that eventually put it on every electronic flight bag in the world. I mean where it came from originally. The actual source. The reason the thing exists at all, I'll tell you. It came from a 23-year-old airmail pilot who got tired of watching his friends die in the Rocky Mountains. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today we're going to sit with that story. But first, a word from today's sponsor. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, commercial certificate, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com now. Let me take you back to 1930. Commercial aviation in America was young, ambitious, and genuinely dangerous. The airmail pilots were the sharp tip of that spear. They flew in weather that would close any modern airport. They flew at night over terrain that wasn't on any useful chart. They flew in open cockpits, then semi-enclosed cockpits, then small tight cabins. And in any of those configurations, the Rocky Mountains treated them with complete indifference. The route between Cheyenne, Wyoming, and Salt Lake City, Utah was one of the hardest in the country. You crossed the Medicine Bow Range. You navigated high mountain passes. The terrain around you reached 11, 12, 13,000 feet. The airplanes doing this work were Boeing Model 40 biplanes, or the bigger Model 80 trimotors, reliable aircraft by the standards of the day, but not particularly powerful. The Pratt and Whitney Wasp radial up front, that nine-cylinder sound that every warbird enthusiast knows from air shows today, was working as hard as it could just to hold altitude over the high ridgelines. The cockpit smelled of oil and leather and the faint, sharp trace of exhaust that seeped past the firewall. In winter, it was cold enough to hurt. Pilots wore everything they owned, layered under their flying suits, and it still wasn't enough in the high passes. In summer, the heat came up off the desert plateaus and the density altitude climbed, and the airplane just stopped performing the way you expected it to. And the navigation, you had a compass and a clock and whatever you could see out the window. The airmail pilots had learned to follow railroad tracks, the iron compass they called it, because the railroads ran through mountain passes at known elevations and they kept you connected to something you could identify. But the high mountain legs sometimes forced you away from the tracks entirely, out into terrain that had no landmarks you could match to any chart, because the charts that existed didn't show you what the ground actually looked like from 5,000 feet above it. When a pilot got caught in cloud over the mountains, in that era, the arithmetic was not good. There was no instrument landing system to follow down to minimums. There was no very high-frequency omnidirectional range to track inbound. You had a magnetic compass and an altimeter and whatever you could remember about the terrain you'd last seen before the gray closed in. Getting caught in cloud over a 12,000-foot ridgeline in a Boeing biplane was, more often than not, how a pilot's story ended. The accident rate from that era is difficult to look at. Pilots were dying regularly on the Western mountain routes. The causes varied: weather, mechanical failure, controlled flight into terrain, downdrafts that exceeded the aircraft's best climb rate. But running underneath all of it was a common problem. Pilots didn't have reliable, organized information about what they were flying into. There were no standard approach procedures, no published obstacle clearance altitudes, no systematic record of what the altimeter setting did at individual mountain airports. And that mattered enormously because an altimeter reads atmospheric pressure, not the ground itself. And if the pressure had shifted between where you set it and where you were flying, you could be hundreds of feet off from what the instrument told you. In the mountains, a few hundred feet is not a rounding error. A few hundred feet is a ridgeline. Power lines crossed approaches at unknown heights. Hills sat in unknown positions relative to runway ends. A pilot landing for the first time at a mountain strip in marginal weather was flying into an information void, relying on experience and instinct and a fair amount of luck. The experienced pilots carried this knowledge in their heads. They'd flown the route so many times that the terrain had become memory. New pilots learned by following the veterans and hoping to survive long enough to build their own mental map. It was an oral tradition, and oral traditions have a fatal weakness. They disappear when the person carrying them does. Ellery Borg Jeppesen decided that was not a system. It was a lottery. Jeppesen had started flying in his late teens, barnstorming in the Pacific Northwest before landing a position with Boeing Air Transport in 1930. He was methodical by nature and precise by preference. He had an engineer's mind and a pilot's body, which is a combination that either saves your life or bores you to death, depending on the flying you're doing. He bought a small notebook, a hardback book maybe 6 inches tall and 4 inches wide, small enough to rest on his knee in the cockpit, and he started filling it. He noted the altimeter settings at each airport on his route, not just the standard pressure setting, but what the field elevation was, what corrections were needed, how the instrument tended to behave in the local conditions. He recorded runway lengths, the lighting or absence of it, the radio range frequencies, the compass headings for each approach, the elevation of the terrain on either side. And then he did something that I think is the most interesting part of this story. He got out of the airplane and walked.
After landing at a field, some rough strip cut into a mountain valley with a gravel surface and a faded windsock, instead of just refueling and pushing on, Jeppesen would leave the airport. He'd walk to the nearest farmhouse. He'd knock on the door. He'd ask the rancher how high those hills were on the south side. Was there a power line on the approach end? In winter, when the snow went flat and the light went sideways, could you even distinguish the runway from the surrounding terrain until you were nearly on top of it? What did the wind do in the afternoon up in this canyon? Where did the clouds start to form when the weather moved in from the west? He was collecting oral history, field-level intelligence. The kind of knowledge that only lives in the minds of people who have spent their lives watching the sky from the ground. He'd estimate obstacle heights by pacing off distances from the runway threshold and doing the geometry in his head. He'd sketch the approach from memory after flying it, and on the next trip through, he'd check his sketch against what he actually saw and correct it, and the flight after that, and the flight after that. Every pass through those mountains was a revision. The notebook grew. One book became several. The sketches got more refined. The data got more complete. Other pilots started hearing about it. A fellow Boeing air transport man would mention he was about to fly a route Jeppesen knew well, and Jeppesen would pull out the book and read from it. The obstacle on the south departure at Salt Lake, the quirky altimeter behavior at a high elevation strip that had cost two pilots before anyone understood what was happening. The power line on short final at a field nobody had properly documented, and eventually somebody said, "Can I get a copy of that?" He started making carbon copies, and he started charging for them. $1 a copy at first, according to some accounts. He eventually settled on something closer to $10 a year for a subscription, with regular updates as he learned more and corrected earlier entries. $10 in 1931, when you could get a decent meal for 30 cents, was real money, but pilots paid it. Because the alternative was flying on guesswork, and they had watched what guesswork cost by 1933, he had about 14 paying customers. Fellow pilots, mostly men who flew the same mountain routes and understood exactly what they were buying. In 1934, he incorporated Jeppesen and Company, Denver, Colorado. The business address was his home. His wife Nadine was part of the operation from early on. It was a family business built on the proposition that organized information saves lives. What he produced were called orientation charts and airport procedures. By today's standards, they look almost primitive. Hand-drawn approach sketches. Typed tables of data. The obstacle clearance altitudes were his best estimates, not precisely surveyed by professional engineers, but compared to what else existed for pilots operating in the mountains, which was essentially nothing systematic, they were worth their weight in gold. Now here's where it gets interesting. What made Jeppesen's charts different from government maps and military publications wasn't just that they covered remote mountain airports in greater detail, it was how the information was organized. Jeppesen thought about the human being sitting in the cockpit. He thought about what a pilot needed during an actual approach to an actual airport in actual weather, and in what order he'd need it. He put the critical information first. He arranged the data the way you'd use it, not the way a bureaucrat would file it. The approach sketch showed what the pilot would actually see out the window on final. The critical altitudes were prominent. The frequencies were where you'd reach for them. That sounds obvious, but it is remarkable how rare obvious ideas are when they first appear. The Second World War accelerated everything. The military needed approach and departure procedures for hundreds of airfields around the world. They needed them standardized and maintained and updated on a regular cycle. Jeppesen's company was one of the very few operations in the country with genuine expertise in producing this kind of information at scale. Government contracts came in. The company expanded rapidly. The one-man Denver operation with a handmade notebook became a real publishing house with a production staff and a revision cycle and contracts with the U.S. Army Air Forces. After the war, the international carriers came. European airlines subscribed. Pacific and Asian carriers. Airlines operating routes across the oceans found that Jeppesen's charts gave them coverage and consistency that national government publications couldn't match, particularly for remote and underdeveloped airfields where the official charts were sparse or non-existent. The charts went from hand-drawn to printed, the revision system formalized. You'd receive your amendment pages on a regular schedule and update your binders, pulling the old plates and inserting the new ones. That whole ritual, which every IFR pilot of a certain vintage remembers in their bones, traces directly back to Jeppesen's early habit of correcting his notebook on the next flight through. By the time Jeppesen sold the company to Times Mirror in 1961, subscriptions ran to carriers on every inhabited continent. The Little Black Notebook had become one of the most important regular publications in the history of aviation. Boeing eventually acquired the company in the early 2000s. There's a certain symmetry in that. Boeing Air Transport was where Jeppesen started flying in 1930. Decades later, the world of instrument flying that he helped create came back to the company where the story began. Let me tell you something about Jepp himself, because I don't want him to get lost in the corporate history. He was a quiet man by most accounts, methodical, not given to self-promotion. Pilots who met him in his later years described someone with a genuine, unhurried curiosity about what you were flying and where you'd been. He'd listen more than he talked. He was a listener in a profession full of storytellers, which is sometimes the most useful thing a person can be. He kept flying himself for many years. He was known as a precise, careful aviator. Not flashy, not aggressive, just consistently excellent. The kind of pilot who makes the same airplane look easier than it is because he's done the thinking before he got in. And he had a quality I find genuinely rare. He was comfortable being wrong when early charts had errors. Because some of this was hand-estimated information about terrain that had never been properly surveyed, he corrected them immediately and reissued them. He didn't defend his mistakes, he fixed them and moved on. That discipline got built into the company culture and it survived long after he sold it. He died in November of 1996 in Marin County, California. 89 years old, he had outlived most of the pilots he flew with, most of the airplanes he'd flown, and most of the airfields he'd sketched by hand in that little black book over the Colorado Rockies. I think about his story whenever a student pilot tells me approach plates are too complicated. Too many numbers, too many boxes, too much fine print. Where do you even start? And I say, pull up a chair. Let me tell you about the man who invented those plates. He started because pilots were dying over the mountains and nobody was organizing what they knew. He knocked on farmhouse doors to ask ranchers about terrain. The first time he sold a copy, he charged a dollar for it. That usually gets their attention. Every time you pull up a Jeppesen approach plate in your flight bag, on your electronic flight bag, in the avionics on your panel, you're using the direct descendant of a black notebook that a 23-year-old airmail pilot carried over the Rocky Mountains in 1930. Because he was too careful to die from ignorance and too generous to keep what he'd learned to himself. Back when Avigas was cheap and airspace was free, one pilot decided that information should be organized, shared, and kept current. And every one of us has been flying safer for it ever since. Sources for this one include the Jeppesen Company, history as documented by Boeing, and materials from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum's collection on early commercial aviation. More at radiohanger.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Keep your plates current.